Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to present once again Kevin Coogan, the author of the consummately important recent volume, Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. Francis Parker Yockey, for those of you who have not heard our previous interviews on the subject, and there are many of them available from Spitfire, about which I will tell you more later, Francis Parker Yockey is a very important international fascist of American origin whose activities span the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II career, and he has landed on many shores, including those of Third Reich intelligence, the pre-war and World War II era underground Nazi milieu in the United States, and perhaps even more importantly, in the post-war period, his works, both his espionage and agitation activities, and in particular his volume Imperium, have not only helped to shape the structure of post-war international fascism, but have wielded a tremendous ideological influence, although to a certain extent unrecognized, on post-war fascism, in particular since his death in 1960. So, Kevin, as a brief summation of your encyclopedic book, how do you think that was?
Pretty good.
All righty. Well, one of the things that I want to talk about in this interview, in fact, one of the themes that I would like to focus on in this interview is an aspect of fascism that has not received a lot of documentation, and that is that even though fascism, as a rule, is diametrically ideologically opposed to communism and socialism, in the confusing world of realpolitik, in which politics often has made strange bedfellows, we have frequently seen alliances between far-right elements and some of the most virulent elements of international fascism. Recently, there has been some press in the United States, all around the world, about German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer and his early political incarnation as a fellow traveler of the Baader-Meinhof gang. And in fact, you talk a little bit about some connections between people like François Genoux and the Baader-Meinhof people, and also sympathies expressed by people like Monsieur Thiriard in France and the Baader-Meinhof people. Since this is a current element in journalism, as current journalistic item, why don't we start off there? How in the world would extreme left-wing terrorists like Baader-Meinhof be not only of interest to, but viewed as potential allies of people like Thiriard and Genoux?
Well, just to back up just a little bit on Joschka Fischer, that's actually a very interesting case. What I suspect may be happening is that Joschka Fischer himself may be being destabilized by these very same elements.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Carlos, who's now sitting in jail in Paris.
By the way, that's Carlos the Jackal.
Yes, exactly, who had been arrested for many acts of terrorism a few years ago. He is now claiming that Joschka Fischer actually ran a kind of a safe house where weapons were placed for the Baader-Meinhof group. There's another very weird story that Ulrike Meinhof's daughter is the woman behind raising this whole question of Joschka Fischer trying to attack him. And it appears that Joschka Fischer may well be in the process of being sort of Watergated as a German autonomon, because they're raising his past, which I believe has no connection at all actually with Baader-Meinhof. There are different traditions in Germany. I mean, Baader-Meinhof was actually disliked by many of the autonomon. I don't want to generalize too much, but they were disliked because Baader-Meinhof was seen as a sort of a cell formation, very mysterious, very Leninist. Just in the same way that equivalent groups in Italy, in the autonomous circles in Italy, many of them did not like the Red Brigades, who were also organized in the same sort of Leninist, ultra-communist type fashion.
By the way, I would note that there are allegations that the milieu of ex-CIA agents Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel, some don't think ex, were allegedly involved with training not only Red Brigades, but also Baader-Meinhof, also known as the Red Army Faction, and Carlos the Jackal. So that's a query to be considered in that context.
And in the Joschka Fischer story, one has to realize that Joschka Fischer became extremely unpopular with the sort of ultra-radical elements because he supported German intervention in Kosovo on the side of NATO and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this sort of gets back to your earlier point about how a fellow like Genoux or a Jean Thiriard in Belgium could possibly support someone, you know, groups like the Baader-Meinhof group. And in fact, it's much more than support. One of the fascinating questions that I explore in my book is the fact that François Junot, who I should say was a really hardcore Nazi supporter, I actually met Junot, actually Martin Lee and I, when we wrote an article for Mother Jones in, I think, 87, interviewed Junot in Switzerland.
That specifically, let me just interject briefly, Kevin. That article was the cover story on the May 1987 Mother Jones and is excerpted at length in Miscellaneous Archive shows 19 and 21 available from Spitfire about the fascist third position. By the way, Junot also, for people who are listening, is spelled capital G-E-N-O-U-D. Continue, Kevin.
When we met Junot, Junot was a fellow who played an extremely important role in the, especially in the post-war Fascist International. Junot was a Swiss banker and had been involved heavily with the Nazis. He, for example, held the rights to the writings of I believe, Martin Bormann. He also held the rights to Hitler's Table Talk. In the 50s, Junot was widely understood as one of the key people involved, and in fact, he actually told us this, that he was involved in getting aid to war criminals in jail. He called them, you know, political prisoners or prisoners of war. So he had a very extensive connection with the far right and was very open about it. This also surfaced when Junot became the major lawyer for Klaus Barbie. Sorry, not lawyer. He became the financier of the legal defense of Klaus Barbie.
Jacques Vergès being a lawyer.
Yes, exactly. And Jacques Vergès was an ultra-leftist, which is kind of where the mystery gets even more interesting. And it then turns out that Junot was in close contact with Carlos. And in fact, there are letters that have been published in the press, sort of pen pal letters between Carlos and François Junot. So Junot is one of these people who has a remarkable ability to have one sort of foot in the far left while coming from the far right. And I think the answer to that is pretty easy to understand when... And it really revolves around the point that Junot, Thiriart, people like that are as much anti-American as they are anti-Russian. In other words, they see Europe as occupied by, you know, American capital as much as by Russian troops. So for them, the idea of using ultra-leftists to sort of fight against the American imperialism was extremely appealing to them because it helped them in this kind of geopolitical maneuver to sort of roll back American influence in particular in Europe.
Recently, and by the way, I'm recording this on January 21st of the year 2001, in the year 2000, Florida came into sharp journalistic relief, both because of the Elian Gonzalez case and also, of course, because of the controversy over the counting of the votes in Florida. And one of the things that received a fair amount of discussion in both cases was the anti-Castro Cuban milieu and the expatriate milieu in Florida. One of the items that we touched on briefly in a previous interview and that I'd like to discuss at somewhat greater length, and that is the ideological support and possible liaison between Francis Parker Yaki, again, a very active and influential and doctrinaire fascist, and the pro-Castro forces in Cuba. To those who have simply become aware of Castro as the anti-Yankee Soviet ally, that again might appear very, very strange. If you could detail a little bit for us about Yaki's affiliation, both ideological and perhaps tactical, with Castro, and how such a thing comes about.
Sure. I think Yaki's support of Cuba should be seen in a broader context of his life and also the post-war Fascist International in general. Yaki had spent a lot of time in the Middle East, where he worked at one point with very closely, in fact, with a man named Johann von Leers. Now, Johann von Leers, in the 1950s, in the mid-1950s, moved to Cairo and became one of the leading, quote-unquote, anti-Zionist propagandists for Nasser. Now, Leers earlier had actually worked for Goebbels and was considered one of the major propagandists for Goebbels and the propaganda ministry. He, after the war, he fled to Argentina and set up a publication called Der Weg, which was based in Perón's Argentina and put out a lot of really extreme post-war Nazi propaganda. He also had, as other writers, people like General Raymer and a man named Rudel, who's a famous Luftwaffe pilot, who was also very influential in the post-war Nazi International. In the mid-50s, however, Leers relocated to Egypt and to Cairo, and began putting out a kind of a propaganda that equated U.S. imperialism as the sort of major curse that the Arabs had to face. In other words, U.S. imperialism was allied with Israel, and they were basically, you know, backstabbing the Arabs. So Yaqui's involvement with people like Lears, who adopted this sort of radical anti-imperialist rhetoric, preceded his overtures to Cuba. What happened specifically is that, what we know about, I should put it this way, is that Yaqui in early 1960 disappeared from the United States and wound up spending at least a month in Cuba. And this may or may not have been the first time. It's a little hard to tell in the files, the FBI files, how many times he visited Cuba. What is clear is that he definitely had a base in Cuba. In fact, when he was arrested, one of the things he tried to do was he tried to get a message back to his friends in Cuba, and I actually discussed this in the introductory chapter to my book. So Yaqui's approach was this approach that saw Castro not as a conventional leftist. Rather, Castro was seen as someone analogous to Juan Perón. In other words, someone who was more an anti-imperialist first than a doctrinaire leftist second. And I think if you think about it, in 1960, when it wasn't all that clear that Castro would have such close ties with the Russians, which in a certain sense Castro was maybe pushed into by the United States' treatment of Castro and the embargo against him, in that earlier period, when Castro just came to power, in fact, Castro came to power January 1st, 1960, in Havana, and Yaqui left for Cuba, I think around March. I think he spent about a month there in March. So there's some reason to think that Yaqui thought that Castro could become someone like a Perón, who, when Perón was forced out of power in Argentina in the mid-1950s, Perón very much himself became a great promoter of sort of America the enemy and anti-imperialism in general.
Kevin, one of the reasons that I refer to your book as encyclopedic, and by the way, it's one of the very few books that I've ever had trouble reading, simply because of the intensity of the information. One of the footnotes to the information about Castro that I found absolutely fascinating was the discussion of the probable role of H. Keith Thompson, who's an individual that we've spoken about before, in not only trafficking arms to Batista, but also later perhaps in liaising with the Castro forces. If you could just tell us a little bit about H. Keith Thompson, who he was, and again, how a connection like that would come to pass.
Again, this is one of these absolutely bizarre stories that seems improbable when one begins the research. Just to flag this, not only did H. Keith Thompson have ties with the Batista elements and was at the same time pro-Castro, but H. Keith Thompson was a very good friend of a man named Lyle Stewart, who is actually a publisher, a leftist publisher. Lyle Stewart at one point was the, I think, the finance chairman of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in the early 1960s. So, and Thompson and Stewart maintained their friendship for years and years and years. So it's even more remarkable that the one of the bigwigs in Fair Play for Cuba, Lyle Stewart, was at the same time a great friend of Thompson's. In fact, one of the things I explore in my book is that Lyle Stewart was actually sued by the former King Farouk of Egypt, because Lyle Stewart had published a book implying that Farouk visited a brothel in Florida. And in the court case, Lyle Stewart, to defend himself, actually turned to H.K. Thompson and said to Thompson, could you please get your contacts in Egypt to give us dirt on the case to block the King Farouk suit? So Thompson went to his right-wing friends in Egypt. I mean, Thompson was, in fact, a pen pal of Johann von Leers, who was living in Cairo, as I mentioned. So it's a very strange world, let's put it that way. And it's even more strange when you realize that Thompson had been an extremely important agent of influence, I put it nicely, for the Germans before, during, and after World War II. Thompson was born in New Jersey, and he became a very close friend of a man named George Sylvester Viereck. Now, George Sylvester Viereck had been a propagandist for Imperial Germany during World War I, and in fact, he was jailed during the war. He then became a great propagandist for Germany during the 1930s and was jailed during World War II, once again, for being basically a foreign agent of the German government. Now, after the war ended, Viereck was actually fairly old at that time, and Thompson became his protege. And actually the way Thompson sort of connected with Yaki in the first place is that Thompson and another friend of Thompson's, a guy named Fred Weiss, who was a longtime German national living in New York, they were sort of on the circuit that Yaki traveled on, so that when Yaki came to New York in the early 1950s, he was naturally introduced both to Thompson and Weiss, as well as Viereck. So Thompson is a person who has very, very strong and well-documented ties to one of the most sophisticated networks of German influence in America. I mean, Viereck, for example, in the 1930s, was actually writing speeches for isolationist congressmen. I mean, Viereck was not a sort of a stumblebum, kind of a crude Bundist, but he was a very well-educated man and in some ways a very well-known poet during the 1930s. So Thompson is a real figure of intrigue, because after Viereck became sort of too old to sort of carry out the day-to-day operations, Thompson took over. And so Thompson, all during the 1950s, was in contact with people like Lears in Egypt. Thompson wrote for Der Weg when Lears was editing Der Weg in Buenos Aires. You can go to Thompson's archives, and you can see letters from various neo-Nazis to him. He's an extremely significant fellow. Now, when I asked Thompson, I was saying to Thompson, well, you know, what was the, I said, asked, this is all through correspondence, so I've never met the gentleman. But when I wrote to him and I said, well, you know, what is going on, the way he explained it to me in regards to Cuba is that he said, look, Batista was a guy who was being betrayed by the Americans, and the Americans were wanting the Americans weren't willing to support him all the way. So that when Batista began to feel undercut, what I was trying to do is that I was trying to work with a certain arms syndicate, which he didn't name, but he said was based in Latin America, essentially to offer Batista weapons and to promote this new source of weapons, which I suspect was very much related to the German illegal weapons deals after the war. And I often wondered whether Klaus Barbie was part of that, because Klaus Barbie was very much involved in weapons dealings in Latin America during the 1950s. But the idea was to say, look, if Batista is going to be shut down by the Americans, we can actually help influence Batista for our point of view through giving him certain deals. And our main point was to move Batista away from sort of American influence and American control. So that when Castro came in, even though Thompson was, I believe, sincerely a Batista supporter, he still saw that the important thing was to sort of weaken U.S. control. Because you have to realize that for someone like Thompson, when he says U.S. control, he means, you know, Wall Street control, and that plugs into sort of anti-Semitism and sort of the Jewish Wall Street conspiracy. So he sees America in a way that, you know, is very different from the way normal people would see the United States. So he felt that as long as Castro was willing to be anti-American, he could be satisfied with that. And I think that may in part explain how a guy like Thompson could maintain his friendship with Lyle Stewart, who had been so much involved in Fair Play for Cuba.
And I would also point out the publisher of a book that I use frequently, the book Martin Borum, A Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. I would also point out that in For the Record program number, or not For the Record, but RFA number 19, we detail the Klaus Barbie, Friedrich Schwend, Otto Skorzeny Latin American arms trafficking milieu, which appears to be implicated in some of Thompson's machinations vis-a-vis Castro. Kevin,
can I just do just one other little thing on this whole point?
Sure.
Just to show how far that Thompson went in this world, Thompson became the literary agent for a fellow named Rockwell Kent. Now, Rockwell Kent was a brilliant artist, but he was also a very well-known Stalinist. And Thompson was his literary agent in the late 1950s. Thompson also worked in the Defense Committee for David Siqueiros, who was a famous Mexican mural painter and communist who had been arrested in 1960, in the early 1960s, I think. And Siqueiros was also very pro-Castro. And you can go to Lyle Stewart's publications. Lyle Stewart had a publication called The Independent, And you can read Thompson's articles in The Independent, including a very extensive survey of the far right, and also Thompson's essay as part of a defense of David Siqueiros. So this is not a casual thing. I mean, he really did have some connections there.
I would also point out, as we've discussed in the past in some meeting on this broadcast, in connection with Martin A. Lee's book, The Beast Reawakens, H. Keith Thompson, and you allude to this too in Dreamer of the Day, became the literary agent for Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother.
Yes.
Some of the other connections, Kevin, between not only doctrinaire communist elements, but between third world elements and international fascist elements. And this is a point that I also want to stress, because frequently, although technically ideological opposites, in terms of political alliances, in particular in terms of their anti-Americanism, some of these elements have become allies. And I also want to remind listeners, particularly younger listeners, that at the same time, as part of what you call the fascist international, Kevin, or the post-war fascist international, was working with communist enemies of the United States. At the same time, the Reinhard Gehlen spy milieu, which overlaps much of the SS post-war underground that you talk about in Dreamer of the Day, was at least ostensibly working with the United States. So in terms of a standard political analysis, not only do we have to be flexible, but I think also in terms of what, for lack of a better term, could be called American counterintelligence, an American counterintelligence perspective, I think that some of these Nazi connections probably go both ways and could have been instrumental and could still perhaps be instrumental in doing a great deal of damage to the United States. Kevin, having been born in 1949, having grown up with the Cold War, and in particular the specter of not just the Soviet Union, but Red China, the Manchurian Candidate, and so forth. Perhaps the Mao Zedong-dominated communist China was seen as perhaps even more sinister in some ways than the former Soviet Union.
Sure.
And yet a very influential gentleman, a former finance minister of the Third Reich, and another prime player in this post-war fascist international, Hjalmar Schacht, was very much involved with Red China in the late 1950s. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about who Schacht was, and how does an individual like Schacht come to be working with Red China?
Well, Schacht was a very complex character, to put it mildly. He began as a banker and was during the 1920s, helped work out negotiations with the United States to stabilize the mark, which was undergoing incredible inflation at that time. He also, in the late 20s, began looking very sympathetically to the Nazi Party, because Schacht saw Hitler as essentially, as far as I can tell, essentially as a kind of a moderate, in the sense that Hitler had punished the radical left wing of the German National Socialist Democratic, National Socialist Workers' Party, the Strasser wing of the group. And so he looked to Hitler. Schacht was a guy who basically sold Hitler to von Papen and a lot of German businessmen to say, Hitler's a fellow we can make a deal with. And the funny thing is, just to bring it back to H.K. Thompson, if you look at, The Independent, which was Lyle Stewart's publication, H.K. Thompson's mentor, Viereck, has a very long article in The Independent discussing a trip that he made, that he, Viereck, made to Germany. And during the trip, he met with his old buddies, von Papen and Schacht. So it's really quite extraordinary that these connections go back that far. Anyway, after the war, Schacht was arrested and jailed as a war criminal. And then when he was released with a few sort of pennies in his pocket. And then a few days later, he's running a bank again. And after the war, he became really a major strategist for German business. And one of the things they wanted to do is they wanted to strongly penetrate into the Third World to pick up markets or wherever they could. And one of the places they went to was communist China. So Schacht actually became, I think in 56 or 57, one of the founding members of a German-China Friendship Association, because Schacht wanted German business to open up deals with China. So he and a lot of these German business interests were willing to look in many different places and ignore the U.S. Formal U.S. policy to rebuild German heavy industry.
Kevin, tell us briefly, because we're down to the last couple of minutes of the interview, about Yalmar Schacht and the Jeddah Agreement. I may be mispronouncing that.
Yeah, the Jeddah Agreement. This is one of the fascinating things. I should say that I first came across this in a book called Spooks, a very good book by Jim Hogan that came out in the 1970s. In short, the Jeddah Agreement was an attempted deal by German industry to refinance their shipbuilding capacities by making a direct deal with Saudi Arabia to say that German tankers would be the exclusive carriers of Saudi oil. And the guy that they tried as their intermediary to work out the details of this is actually Aristotle Onassis. Now, what happened is that the Seven Sisters companies suddenly freaked out at this, and they began a very long campaign to block the Jeddah Agreement, and this is detailed at length in Hogan's book. Now, the thing that's very fascinating about this is that some of the people that were involved from the American side in trying to block Jeddah, which essentially they succeeded in doing, they were saying that the CIA itself, namely Alan Dulles, was actually rather reluctant to oppose Schacht in this effort. And one of the reasons why I think that may be the case is that Dulles, in order to understand Dulles, you have to realize that Dulles was a State Department official in World War One, and had been involved in the attempted sort of reorganization of Germany.
By the way, this is John Foster, not his kid brother Alan.
No, this is Alan. I'll tell you, Alan. Alan is the CIA director who was also involved with the State Department.
Yeah, but I didn't realize he was involved in World War One. I thought his State Department involvement came later.
No, he was actually Alan Dulles was actually working for the American embassy in Switzerland during World War One, and there's the famous story that Lenin apparently tried to contact Alan Dulles, and Dulles was out playing tennis, so Dulles never met with Lenin.
I stand enlightened that. I thought it was only John Foster who was active that early. Go ahead, Kevin, because we're almost out of time.
But in brief, Dulles himself, both Dulleses, I should say, wanted kind of a strong Germany because they realized, in part, that the flaw of World War One was that Germany was so weakened by the Versailles Treaty. So I think what happened is that people like Dulles were willing... who also, I should say, had economic deals with the Germans, were willing to take a blind eye in many cases to the activities of people like Schacht because they were themselves wanting to rebuild German heavy industry as well.
All righty. Well, Kevin, we are out of time in this interview. One of the things that I wanted to get to when we visit next is some of the connections between what you call the New York Nazis, the National Renaissance Party, and again, a fascinating panoply of connections running to black nationalist elements or African nationalist elements in the United States and other political alliances that one would not necessarily suspect. We've been visiting with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. That was published in softcover by Autono Media Books. Their address is P.O. Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568. Phone and fax 718-963-2603. And you can visit their website at www.autonomedia.org. By the way, the book was edited by Dave Mandel, a radio personality on WFMU Jersey City, which carries these broadcasts. And you can access some of the previous interviews that I've done with Kevin Coogan, along with the other tapes that I've done and alluded to in this program. They're available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire. You can visit them at or write to them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email them at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. These broadcasts are also now being archived on Real Audio by the aforementioned WFMU-FM in Jersey City. You can visit their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, DAVEEMORY. This has been For the Record Program 270, being recorded on January 21st of the year 2001. For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.